Our reading this morning is part of the gospel, that part of the gospel that we know as the trial of Jesus. And if we look at this reading, this lengthy reading, as if it were a play, we would see that this play has four acts and a cast of characters. Now, the play is set in Jerusalem on the day following the night of the Passover meal. And on that night, Jesus celebrated the Passover meal with his disciples. And then following the meal, they left the city and returned to the Mount of Olives, where Jesus instructed them to pray. Jesus himself also prayed, but the others dozed off. Judas arrived in the night, leading a crowd intent on arresting Jesus. And they carry him back to Jerusalem to the house of the chief priest. Peter follows them, but when he is identified, he claims not to know Jesus. Jesus is then beaten and mocked by the guards. And last Sunday, I described this time as the darkest night in the gospel. Because during this night, Jesus is left utterly alone. Everyone around him fails him, betrays him, denies him, mocks him. But then daylight comes, and it brings us to our reading now. In the first act of this play, Jesus is brought before the Jewish leaders. In the second act, he is taken before Pilate. In the third act, he is interrogated by Herod. And then in the fourth act, he is again brought to Pilate. The characters in this play, they include Jesus, who is the prophet from Galilee. And then there are the members of the Jewish assembly. And this includes the elders of the people, the chief priest and the scribes. And this group make up what we call the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was like a cross between the city council and a church board. It was a religious body, but it also had secular authority. And the Sanhedrin governed the day-to-day matters of the Jewish people in each town. They operated under the rule of the Roman government, and the Jerusalem Sanhedrin would have been the most powerful of all the groups in Israel. Now, the next character in our list is Pilate, Pontius Pilate. He was the prefect or governor of the Roman province of Judea. He was appointed to this post by Emperor Tiberius. Normally, Pilate would have governed from the Roman city of Caesarea Maritima, which was on the coast, because that was Rome's administrative center. However, for the Jewish Passover festival, he would have relocated to Jerusalem along with his soldiers in order to keep the peace. Then there is Herod. Now, the Herod in this story, because there's several, is Herod Antipas. His father was Herod the Great, whom we know from Matthew's gospel as the one who ordered the murder of all the boy children in Bethlehem at the time of Jesus' birth. Herod Antipas, the son, was the tetrarch of Galilee. He is also the one responsible for the death of John the Baptist. Antipas was appointed to his position by Emperor Augustus, and he served beneath Pilate. Rounding out our cast list for this play are Herod's soldiers, and they are likely to be Jewish citizens and not Roman. In the first act of the drama, Jesus is brought in before the Sanhedrin. Now, remember, he had been arrested a few hours earlier in the darkness of night and brought to the home of the chief priest in Jerusalem. And now that day has arrived, the council convenes, and they begin to interrogate Jesus. This interrogation is of a theological nature. They are trying to determine if he has violated the law of Moses by claiming to be divine. They ask him this question: if you are the Messiah, tell us. His response to them is, if I tell you, you won't believe. And then if I ask you any questions, you're not going to answer me. Jesus knows how this plays out. He knows that their minds are made up and that they are simply looking for any excuse to have him killed, to get rid of him. It doesn't matter what he says, and he knows that they won't speak the truth to him. But he tells them, from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. This particular statement combines imagery from the book of Daniel and the book of Psalms. In the book of Daniel, Daniel has a vision. And in this vision, he tells about the Son of Man who came with the clouds of heaven and who was given power by God. Psalm 110 opens with these words, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand." When Jesus says, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God, the implication is clear. The members of the council would recognize the imagery. And so, in response to that, they ask him, "So, are you saying that you are the Son of God?" And Jesus responds, "You say that I am." And this is not an answer to their question. Jesus is instead placing responsibility for their actions back on their shoulders. Their conclusion is that, yes, he is indeed claiming to be the Messiah, because they say, "What further testimony do we need? We've heard it ourselves from his own lips." Of course, Jesus did not confess to any of this. To be clear, we call the events of this day the trial of Jesus, but clearly it's not a trial. It's more like a hearing. There are no witnesses or judges, just people in power asking questions. In the second act, Jesus is taken by the Sanhedrin to Pilate. The council intends that Jesus is to be executed, but only the Romans have the authority to carry out capital punishment. Pilate can order an execution. And the complaints that the council bring to Pilate are different than the ones we saw in the first act. The Romans, they don't care about a Jewish Messiah, so the council amends their complaints to something more political, something that will engage the Romans. They say to Pilate, "We found this man perverting our nation, forbidding us to pay taxes to the emperor, and saying that he himself is the Messiah, a king." Personally, I'm glad that times have changed and that in our current political conversation, we aren't fixated on things like morality, or taxes, or which candidate can fix the world. No, we're beyond that. The Sanhedrin, however, accuses Jesus of perverting the nation, of forbidding the people to pay taxes, and thirdly, claiming to be a Messiah. And then to clarify that last statement, they add a king. Because, as I said, the Romans would have no interest in a Messiah, but a self-proclaimed king would be a potential threat to Roman authority, and that is a serious charge. So Pilate turns to Jesus and asks him this question: "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answers as he did to the council, "You say so." But unlike the council, Pilate interprets this in the negative and declares to them, "I find no basis for an accusation against this man." The Sanhedrin persist, adding a fourth complaint. They say, "He stirs up the people by teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee, where he began, even to this place." Ah, now that Jesus is from Galilee apparently is news to Pilate. And so he seizes on this opportunity to pass this sticky matter over to somebody else. Pilate sends Jesus to Herod, because Herod is the tetrarch of Galilee, and Galilee is Herod's jurisdiction, and this matter clearly belongs in his hands. Let him handle it. And conveniently enough, Herod just happened to be in Jerusalem for the festival. So this brings us to the third act of our play, which takes place in the presence of Herod. Herod was already aware of Jesus from his ministry in Galilee, and it seems was anxious to meet him. Herod was hoping that Jesus would perform one of his famous miracles. Who doesn't like a good magic show? For Herod, Jesus is not a threat so much as he is a curiosity. Herod interrogates Jesus, but Jesus never responds. The council continues, however, to make loud accusations against Jesus, but even Herod can find no indictment against him. Nonetheless, he allows his soldiers to mock Jesus. They dress him up in a fancy robe as if he really were a king and sends the matter back to Pilate. In the fourth and final act of this drama, Pilate calls the Sanhedrin before him, and he reviews the charges brought against Jesus. He declares that neither he nor Herod find him guilty of any of these charges. As Pilate says, indeed, he has done nothing to deserve death. Pilate proposes to have Jesus flogged and released. The council erupts in fury, and instead they demand that Barabbas be set free. Now, who is Barabbas? Barabbas was a jailed insurrectionary who no doubt was a participant in one of the Jewish uprisings in Rome. He is also clearly a violent man and has been labeled a murderer. As we read in the other Gospels, there was this Passover tradition that the Romans would release a prisoner for the festival. And this year, the council called for Barabbas to be released. What is really interesting about Barabbas is his name. Because in Aramaic, which was the language of Judea, it would be Barabbas or Bar Abba, which is literally Bar for son, Abba, father. Son of the father. It's ironic that the crowd is demanding that the son of the father, the son of God, the murderer, be released, and that Jesus be crucified. The crowd shouts at Pilate, "Crucify, crucify him." And Pilate is seemingly exasperated by this entire matter. He repeats that he has found Jesus guilty of no crime. But the crowd keeps shouting, and finally Pilate relents. And he orders that Barabbas be set free and that Jesus be crucified. That's the end of our play. And I have to be honest, I have struggled with this passage this week. Understanding the sequence of events, first act through fourth act, that's fairly straightforward. But when I went to apply that question I've been asking each week, what is Luke teaching his people? I came up short. I found no lessons here, no teachings, no parables or signs. It's just events, facts as Luke presents them. Now, we could look at Jesus' non-specific statements, "You say so." There's sermons there. Or we could explore Jesus' future claim of having power at God's right hand. And that indeed is part of the promise of God's kingdom. But I believe what we find here most importantly is that it is part of Luke's chronicle of Jesus' life. He states right at the beginning of the gospel, "I decided to write an orderly account for you." And today's reading is a report of this pivotal moment in Jesus' life, the trial that led to his crucifixion. And in teaching his congregation about Jesus, Luke certainly can't avoid this day. He can't skip over it, because more than Jesus' teaching or preaching or signs and miracles, Jesus is the one who was sacrificed. He is, as he claimed, the Passover lamb. It is his blood that saves us. And the lesson that Luke offers his people, I think clearly, is that this happened. And that despite God's commandment against killing, an innocent man was purposely executed to fulfill the agenda of those in power. And for Luke, this moves the story along. This tells us of God's plan in this world. Now, many states in the U.S. have abolished the death penalty. Most notably among them is Illinois, whose lawmakers voted in 2011 to abolish capital punishment. 10 years earlier, the governor had imposed a moratorium on executions after the courts in that state discovered that 13 men on death row had been wrongly accused. The governor said, "There is something wrong with our system." Currently, 30 states permit capital punishment, including Tennessee. And we have to remember, each time that this state carries out an execution, we have to ask the question, are we sure that person is guilty? Are we absolutely sure beyond a shadow of a doubt? Because once we kill someone, they're not coming back. A life is lost. You can't undo an execution. And today we continually hear of people who have been on death row, who are released because the DNA testing shows that the blood or the hair or the skin samples that were found at the crime scene, the evidence that convicted them was wrong. Innocent people have been executed for crimes that they did not commit. So this allows us to ask the question, what would this world be like if Jesus had been allowed to continue his ministry? What if the council and the people, instead of demanding his death, had instead embraced his message? Would we be living in the kingdom today? I don't know. We will never know. Because when Jesus was killed, we lost the chance to find out. When a person is executed, we lose the opportunity to see what they might bring to this world. For me, the lesson from this is that an innocent man was wrongly convicted and executed. Maybe in Jesus' case, that is how it had to be. Maybe that is God's plan. But I do know that once he was killed, despite the resurrection, the deed was done. We could never go back, and this world has, because of that, lost something precious. Amen.